Blog Talk Radio.
Again, hey, I hope your day is going well. This is Cliff, your host. last week, we had John Brandenburg on the program, Dr. Brandenburg, and got quite a bit of email regarding his material. And I've actually posted a couple of the photographs, most notably the two other phases that he found in the Elipsian region close to the Cydonia area of Mars. And there's been quite a bit of independent research on that whole area since Dr. Brandenburg published his book, his first book. And so a number of people were saying, well, we already knew about this. But the thing is, some of these early Viking photographs are very clear. In fact, they're astonishingly clear. and it's the only chance to get these images. So make sure that you have, if you listen to that show, make sure you go to the Facebook Earth Ancients page and have a look at Brandenburg's photographs. And his view of the atomic detonation points, which are in that Cydonian region. Remember what he said, which is pretty startling, is that whoever dropped those bombs, nuclear bombs, had in their mind genocide as a point of reference. In other words, they wanted to wipe the planet clean of those, whatever race was there. And the other startling thing is that as a weapons expert, his estimation was that the two bombs that were dropped on that region of Mars were as big as the Empire State Building. I don't have a clue. I should have asked how he figured that out, but I guess the actual explosion can be measured, the actual detonation and size of the originating bomb can be calculated in size. Two bombs the size of the Empire State Building is mind-blowing, just completely mind-blowing. So anyhow, I did post right after the show some images of the book, and I really am. It's a fascinating piece of work, his book. And if you didn't get a chance again to, the book is Death on Mars: The Discovery of a Planetary Nuclear Massacre. And the other thing is, were you as blown away as I was when he basically said it was 250 million years ago? I mean, that to me is just, that's another thing. It's kind of amazing is those ruins are half a quarter of a billion years old. That's just too much. I mean, God. I was like, okay. Wow. We got to get out there. I mean, come on, NASA. the cat's out of the bag. I mean, let's go, let's get in there. Let's say, hey, we found ruins. We're going to go there. We're going to have some manned exhibitions, explorations, and let's go and actually check these areas out. Because, come on, well, I mean, what are we waiting for? What? They must think we're imbeciles if they think that there's we don't have evidence of, as John says, archaeology, ruins of an ancient civilization. I mean, let's get out there. Let's get over this. So anyhow, I continue to be fascinated by Mars, as you all know. And I hope that program was interesting to you, because it was just amazing what they discovered. Fascinating new website by Holly Amberg. Remember, Holly was the armchair archaeologist who, using Google Earth, discovered a lost civilization in the Atacama Desert of northern Chile. And Holly has just released a new website, Nuevo Albergues, and it's actually www.nuevoalbergues.com, and it's filled with amazing photographs from satellite imagery that she discovered, some of the original imagery, and also ground-based imagery of the site. And we have with us right now, Holly's joined us. Hi, Holly. How are you?
Hello.
Well, tell us a little bit about this this website. It's fascinating. It actually has all of your photographs from the originating satellite imagery that you discovered and placed in the Atacama Desert, and also some ground level photographs. Tell us a little bit about some of these photographs.
Yes. The ground-based photos were taken by people that I had sent there, and they had a car for about 2 or 3, 4 hours, and we tried to take as many photos as we could at that time. But from the ground, basically, there's not much to see because the whole site is so blown over by sand or whatever 10,000 years ago, so there's nothing visible on the ground. You have to get up on the air to see the outlines of the buildings and the salt pans, whatever there was. And the ground images basically are so far not very exciting to see, but we saw many new ground images because Google had a camera car going into that area close to that Albergues. And those ground images, wherever they were, they could go in the car. They had the camera pointed off the road, and we could see quite a bit of ruins on the side of the hills. So we have both images at Nuevos, which are basically nothing, flat ground, and then the car from Google Earth went into the hill area, and we could see quite a bit of the ruins. We have so far close to 270 places of human habitations.
In that one area. It's in that one area. Yeah.
Yes.
That's funny. You know, I remember you mentioning that Google Earth had sent somebody with one of their cars to photograph a lot of the ground area. And so a lot of those photographs are actually of various ruined buildings. And I think I remember
Yes.
seeing there was some actual plantation leveling, different levels
Yes. Yes.
of built up plantation. Yeah.
Yeah,
Now,
terraces. Yeah.
yeah, terraces. Yeah. So, has there been any serious archaeological studies done since you had, I guess you had Brian Forrester go out there
Yes,
with
yes.
his team, but has there been any significant announcements that they're going to be going out to the Atacama Desert to do some?
No. So far, we have no results from any archaeology university or company that has gone there. So far, this is mostly unexplored country, and we think we have found something that may be 10,000 years old, yet no normal or current archaeology department of any company has so seen the reason to get there.
Wow.
So we have to wait. We have to wait and see what they will eventually find out there. Because so
Okay.
far I have not found any cemeteries, so we don't know what the skeletons there may be looking like. They may have parts of the elongated craniums that Brian Forster found in Paracas.
Yeah.
So it's
If that,
important that
yeah.
somebody has to go there.
Now it's interesting because I spoke to an archaeologist about 4 months ago who mentioned that an independent research team was going to be going out there, and it was significant enough for the Chilean government to begin patrolling the area to reduce the looting and the damage of some of the ruined areas. So I expect to hear from certain publications about this in the near future, but we just don't know. We just don't know when, I guess. It's expensive to get a
Time will tell. Time will tell.
time. So the website is Nuevo Albergues. .com, and so I guess you'll be continually posting photographs. What I'm going to do is I'm going to list this new site on Earth Ancients Facebook, and I'll post a few photographs from it if you don't mind, Holly.
No problem at all. No,
Okay,
we need
and
all. Go
yeah, go
ahead.
ahead.
No, we need all publicity we can for the site.
Yeah, we need to get the word out. So I'll post it on the blog, Facebook blog, Earth Ancients, and then the Facebook International page,
Yeah.
startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. And this is definitely one of those since it fits in under lost civilization. So thanks for joining us for a little bit, Holly, and we'll look forward to hearing about Nuevo Albergues in the near future.
Thank you very much, and I will have new images of new areas coming up soon.
Very good. We'll look forward to checking that out. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. So, yeah, check that out. It'll be on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients, and also on the blog. So, those of you, I want to also make an announcement. Those of you that live in Northern California, I'm going to be at an art exhibition next Friday, May the 8th, in Alameda, California. And a good friend of mine, Deborah Kemsey, is exhibiting some fascinating art. The title is Art as a Spiritual Journey. And hey, come on out. It's from 6 to 9. The address is it's at the Redux Studio, 2315 Lincoln Avenue. It's in Alameda. And her work is fascinating. She's a close friend of mine. And this is a chance to see not only some fascinating art, but she's a unique sculptor because she uses traditional tools to actually hand carve into these pieces of wood. The other unique thing about Deborah is that she uses a lot of recycled wood and parts in constructing her sculptures. And her work's just fascinating. So, hey, come out and see me. Come out and say hi. Part of the show is also featuring some craft beer. So we'll be pouring that. It's all complimentary. And, hey, we got a little champagne, too. So it's next Friday at Redux Studio in Alameda. Come on out. Say hi to me. Meet the artist, Deborah, and see some great art from 6 to 9. Hey, and I'll pour you a beer, too. Check it out. I'll post it on the Facebook page. And her art, like I said, is quite unique. Actually going to post a couple of her small pieces, too. She's a special friend of mine also. So she's quite unique. Check it out next Friday at the 8th. Today's program is focused on Mike Barra. And by the way, I was in San Mateo, which is just south of San Francisco, last week. I'm still involved doing conferences more as a consultant than actually complete program director. And George Norrie was out there from Coast to Coast AM. And I actually invited Mike Barra to come out and be on the program. And he graciously flew out from Los Angeles. Mike's new book is Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. And as you know, I'm very sensitive about the ancient alien situation because I believe that the whole ancient alien program has kind of pushed the envelope a little bit. And everything that's anomalous in construction or artifacts that cannot be explained scientifically is all automatically diverted to an alien emphasis or hypothesis. In other words, everything that can't be explained is alien in origin. And that's just not how I feel. And the evidence is beginning to come out that there were earlier Earth-based civilizations that were highly sophisticated, many as sophisticated as we are today and more so. Some of the technology that have been found in Central South America and in Europe reveals an understanding of natural occurring Earth energies, tapping into these energies, and then diverting them into potential machines of a certain quality, certain function to power conveniences. And I believe even machines that flew and home-based machines like we have today. So anyhow, this program is focused on Mike Barra. Mike has been traveling extensively. So this is a pre-recording. It's done just a couple of days ago. And we're going to run it. It runs for about an hour. But this is a very, very interesting book, Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. You can get it on Amazon. Just came out just a few weeks ago. So here's the interview that I conducted. I'll come back to you in a little bit after the presentation and talk to you about what's coming up in the coming weeks. So here's the interview.
Today my guest is Mike Barra. We've had Mike on before, and it was really a pleasure to finally meet Mike. I helped co-produce part of the New Living Expo that Mike so graciously came up to join us at. That was this last Saturday, the 25th. Actually, he was there on the 26th too. And Mike was there with George Norrie and a number of other people on panels. And the panel discussion that he was on with George Norrie was standing room only. It was insane. And that was fun.
It was great. And I think, it was really fun.
Yeah, and I think, Mike, you can I stepped into your own presentation, and I think you had a pretty good crowd in your own room 5. Wasn't it well attended?
Oh yeah, it was very well attended, and it, you know, especially since it was I think it was 11 in the morning, 11:30. It's usually at these things on a Saturday, the crowd gets there about 2 in the afternoon. So I was real pleased with the attendance I got, and it was fun. It's always fun to do a presentation clip because it's like, you know, you get to be a star, you get to be on stage, and you really can't put a price on that. It really is satisfying. No, it's great. It's great for your ego, and it's really fun to like. To be talking about things that people actually care about, and to be with like-minded people is really a privilege. So it was great.
Yeah, that was great. Now, actually, we had you working pretty good at that event. I think I actually even put you on a UFO panel that got very long and intense, and that was another standing room only too. So. But I wasn't actually the one who formulated that. That was somebody else who put that group together. Mm-hmm. So that was another chance to talk about your thing there. So you were very busy, and I appreciate you being so available at that conference. But I want to talk about this new book, Mike, Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. Mm-hmm. I got a digital version of it just a couple of days ago, and the promo is a very interesting promo. I'm going to read it here in a second here. It's actually, I'm going to read it right now. Did ancient visitors of extraterrestrial origin come to Earth long, long ago and fashion man in their own image? Did they then lift the human race out of the ashes of a great global catastrophe around 10,500 BC? Were the science and secrets that they taught the ancients intended to be a guide for all humanity to the present era? Was this critical information about our future and our future and our true past hijacked by secretive cabals, some with bad intent and some with altruistic designs, who have held these secrets over the millennia? New York Times bestselling author Mike Barra says, "The answer to each of these questions is yes." Okay, so look, I've had you on the program before talking about ancient aliens on Mars. Yes. We talked a little bit about your earlier book, Ancient Aliens on the Moon. And I'm curious, tell me where this book fits in. Because this is, and we're gonna basically talk, you know, in part about the book. The book is, by the way, is excellent. It's very well written, very detailed.
Thank you.
Has wonderful content that all you listeners out there are really going to like. But is this a follow-up to Ancient Aliens on the Moon and Mars, or was it? Did you discover some information while you were researching those earlier books that made you kind of triggered you into wanting to write this book? Tell us about that.
Well, no, it's a follow-up in the sense that, you know, after I'd gotten done with Ancient Aliens on the Moon and the two Ancient Aliens on Mars books, Mars 1 and Mars 2, after those two, you know, three books, a trilogy, the Ancient Aliens trilogy, I kind of wanted to make it a quadrilogy or whatever you might want to call it. I just started saying to myself, you know, I'm left here with what I think is absolute indisputable proof that there was some civilization on the moon and civilization or civilizations on Mars, and that at least some of them, and probably the most recent ones, were human or humanoid. And, you know, when that starts to hit you and you really think about it, well, like, wow, I think I've pretty much proven my case here and I don't need to write another book about Mars or the moon. Then I started thinking about, well, who were these guys? And you know, the logical progression from that question is, you know, they probably were Sitchins and Anunnaki, because for me, as I look at the architecture of the face on Mars and the pyramid, the ziggurat on the moon, and the glass towers on the moon, and the various mechanical devices and things that the rovers have photographed in the pyramids of Elysium and so forth on Mars, as I look at this stuff, I say, okay, this is human architecture. It is really indistinguishable from the things that we build. So the question then for me becomes, is that because there is a universal method of engineering, or would a truly alien species have, you know, a completely alien aesthetic? And I think that they probably would have a truly alien aesthetic. So when I looked at this stuff, I felt like, okay, somehow this is related, you know, to the human civilization that we have here on Earth. And when that hit me, I thought, well, the next question then is, who were they? Why did they come here? What did they do? How are they involved in the building of this stuff? And that led me to start asking those questions and start thinking about writing another book. And then, you know, I figured, well, if I'm asking these questions, then my audience, you know, such as it is probably asking the same questions, and they would like to know the answers. So I'm going to sit down and see if I can figure out the answers for them. That's how the book got started.
Well, it's fascinating because you take a historic perspective, and I'm not going to give away some of the real meat here, but we're going to definitely talk about it. You actually talk about the flood, and you talk about it in such a way that it's an actual scientific look at the possibilities of a flood and the ramifications that are touched upon by different indigenous cultures, as well as various legends and myths that are left around the world. Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered in your research? You actually even refer to Randall Carlson's work and the geological mm-hmm. evidence of a great flood that happened 12,500 to 13,000 years ago.
That was, you know, it was where the first two chapters I thought were going to be very short, and they were both both those chapters were like episodes in a TV series or something where you're kind of building the background and building the base. And I thought, okay, we're going to talk a little bit about whether the flood actually happened, and then we're going to talk about exactly what happened after the flood, as near as we can piece it together. Excuse me. And they ended up being really massively long chapters full of a lot of information. They made the book a lot thicker than I expected it to be when it started. I kind of really got fascinated with that whole question. So the first thing to establish was that, looking again at work like the work of Randall Carlson, what you figure out is that there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that something catastrophic happened on the planet Earth about 12 or 13,000 BC, and that it was the great flood of the Bible and all the other cultural myths. I mean, there are civilizations all over the globe that have flood myths. They are their own unique versions of it, but it is in essence the same story, and it always tells of the fact that a few humans and a lot of the animals and their seeds, in other words, probably their DNA, were saved aboard this boat that was built. And so that's kind of where all that stuff got started. And Carlson did a really incredible job of piecing together the fact that there's almost certainly a comet strike on the North Polar Cap, which would have caused something akin to the Great Flood and perhaps 40 days and 40 nights of rain. And that's even without the water vapor canopy theory, which I think is stronger than a lot of people give it credit for, of the Earth, which is the idea that the Earth was at one point sort of encased in the upper atmosphere in this very dense water vapor canopy that was probably pierced by this object and subsequently destroyed, and that's what caused the so-called 40 days and 40 nights of rain. So anyway, it was that stuff was really fascinating to me. I didn't know it going in.
Right, and I think the interesting part of that is that you basically show that the vast majority of Earth civilizations were wiped off the planet, and except for a few pockets of people, humanity was destroyed. But what I found was also interesting is you brought up an old friend of mine. I actually had the marine salvage expert David Fasthold at a Whole Life Expo, which is kind of like the expo you attended, which was New Life.
Mm-hmm.
David Fasthold, two years before he passed away, gave a lecture about finding the Ark, Noah's Ark at Mount Ararat.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually go into some wonderful details about this. And tell us a little bit about what you discovered, that the Ark actually exists. Go ahead.
The second chapter is called From the Sky Down, and stealing a turn of phrase from U2, which I love to do. And basically what the essence of the concept is that, you know, human civilization starts at high altitude and then it descends. And the only explanation for that is that there was this great flood similar to the biblical stories. And again, you can look at places like Machu Picchu, you can look at all the very high altitude stuff in Peru, you can look at the terrace civilizations that are dated back to that time, and then you have, like, for instance, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which has been discovered, which is, you know, at about, I think, about 10,500 years old. It's at a very, very high altitude, and it was deliberately buried and abandoned. And, you know, it makes no sense if you have a very fertile valley below, which is what is there today, why you would build a temple up in the mountains for whatever reason. So, you know, these things all led me to think, okay, well, there probably was some kind of flood, and the civilization seems to have started at high altitude and then descended. And that brings up the next question. Well, if there was a flood, then there must have been an ark. And if there was an ark, then what is the history of it, and can we find it? I mean, I'm an artifact hunter. That's what I do. I like to find relics and artifacts. And so when you talk about the ultimate relic or the ultimate artifact, it would have to be Noah's Ark. So what I discovered is that there's two really good possibilities for the location of Noah's Ark. They're both on or near Mount Ararat, which is where the Bible says that the Ark came to rest, the mountains of Ararat. And one of the sites is what's called the Ararat Anomaly, very high up on the mountain, which has been photographed repeatedly. And I showed several photographs in the book that have been taken and told stories of people who appear to have sighted the Ark, broken now, cleaved into two pieces. At one time in the early 20th century, there were a couple of people who claimed to have found the Ark fully intact, but others say it's now broken into two pieces, some later sightings, and those were pretty convincing reports. And then there was the second option, which is the so-called Darunapar site in Turkey, in the mountains around Mount Ararat, and it's been investigated by a whole bunch of different investigators over the years. The first time, I think, seriously, was in 1960. And David Fasthold is one of the leading guys who investigated the site. And one of the things they found were these large so-called drogue stones, which are stones with holes cut in them that you could have used to drag behind the Ark to stabilize it and eventually to end. Because there's some thought that the stones that are at the site are actually reproductions, local reproductions of these original stones, but that they're based on the original stones. And, you know, as I dig into the reports of that site, what I found was that the locals have been, you know, all along have said, yeah, this is Noah's Ark. And there's a boat-shaped formation. And, you know, some people claim it's natural, but there's so many factors that go into it that show that it's not natural. For instance, they used some ground-penetrating radar. I think that was one of the first things that Fasthold did. And, you know, there's keel beams, there's cross supports, there's side structures on the side, there's, what do you want to call it, like side support
ribs.
Structure like you would build in a boat. Ribs in the boat.
Yeah.
That have been photographed. They found metal rivets. They found animal remains. You know, and so you look at this whole thing, and there's really, to my mind, not a lot of question that it's probably the most likely candidate for being the remains of the Ark. So, you know,
right.
That's kind of the conclusion I came to.
Yeah, it was fascinating, the detail that you go into. One of the things that I didn't get, that maybe you can tell us about, is a lot of the remains of this so-called ship or ark were petrified, which means that would show great age. Do we know, has any of that area been carbon dated to know what the true date of that ship is?
Well, there's been a little bit of carbon dating of some of the stuff around it, but again, like you say, the wood has become petrified. It's basically fossilized. It's taken on the characteristics of the rock and the dirt around it. But there has been some carbon dating done on some of the stuff, and it is at least 9,000 years old. So it goes back a ways to about 77,000 BC at a minimum. So I don't know how the hell you get a boat 6,000 to 8,000 feet up on a mountain 7,000 years ago or older than that. I don't know how you get a boat up there. And it certainly appears to be, in my opinion anyway, the wreckage of a boat. How do you get a boat at that altitude? Why would you do it in the first place? Unless there was water up there at one time.
Yeah.
And, it's all consistent with the stories of the Ark. So, I don't see any reason to say it's not the Ark. It certainly looks like it's a really good candidate.
I guess the only way to know it for sure is if you had a gravesite that said, Noah died here.
Well, there are some things around there. There are some things around there that appear to be temples and so forth. And there are stories in the Bible that Noah built a temple to God after he got there, after he landed on dry land. So maybe that's exactly what we're finding. Although, again, going back 12,000 some odd years, that's a long time. And, is it possible this stuff survived? Absolutely. Because remember, we've been in an era of glacial retreat now for about 22,000 years. So at 12,000 years ago, it would have been very cold up there and a lot of snow and a lot of ice. And, without a doubt, it would have definitely been well-preserved. It could have been preserved for thousands of years in the ice up there. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It's, to me, I think it's just really a fascinating place. I'd love to go there sometime.
It is. It's a fascinating look. You continue on, and you get into the offspring of the Watchers, the Nephilim. And you begin talking about their influence, and you spend a good amount of time talking about Zachariah Sitchin and his work and reference it quite a bit. Would you say that influence, and we're going to get into what I think is the Mike Barra specialty, which is the story of NASA, but would you say that their influences is present, even though physically they're not here? We've spoken to Michael Tellinger, who believes that there's an essence, a presence of Nephilim here, not necessarily their offspring, but some kind of energetics at play. What do you say about that?
Well, that's not so much my area of expertise. What I will say is that I have been told by people who do have government contacts that there are representatives of the Anunnaki still on the Earth, that they are the same size as we are. They are genetically very, very similar to us at this point. They've continued to tweak their genetics, but they are here, and they are involved in our government, and he even told me who a couple of them were, and, it doesn't, they're guys that have, they certainly don't look their age, let's put it that way, their official age. I mean, they certainly seem to be guys that have, they're in positions of authority, they're very commanding, and, what I was told in essence is that they are still here to sort of offset the bad karma that they created while they were running things on Earth, and that this really is our planet now, but that they're here to try to guide us to the right resolutions to the issues that face us today. And I can't discount that based on that. Mm-hmm. And I one of the things I don't think I really talked about in the book to the extent that I should have, but I'm going to do it in my lectures when I go on different lectures about this subject is that, the two main combatants, if you will, in Sitchin's histories are the brothers Enki and Enlil, who were the sons of Anu, the Anunnaki king, the king of Nibiru. And I've come to the conclusion that I don't believe, I believe Enki is still here. I don't think that he has left, given their lifespans. I think he stayed here, and I don't have a lot of evidence to support that, but I have a gut feeling that that he is still here, the one who helped to create man's bodies in the first place, our bodies, not our souls, obviously. But I think he's still here, and I think it's still part of the team that's trying to head us in the right direction.
Do you think he's here because you have a sense of his signature in when you see certain types of people, or is it just a gut feeling, just watching groups of people, or what? What gives you that feeling?
I want to get into this. Yes, I guess I have to. I've been told he's still here. And
okay.
By somebody who might know. And also, people, when they talk about Sitchin, they discuss him in terms mostly of the 12th Planet, Wars of Gods and Men, the early works. But, he translated a lot of stuff later on. And it had contained different information about who they were and where they came from. And that information is a little bit in contradiction with some of the original interpretations that he made. And I happen to know from some sources that I'm not going to reveal that he got this information directly from them. Kind of like, the film Interview with a Vampire? It's kind of like that. That's about as close as I'm going to. As I'm going to come, and I believe that story is on this. Also, I think that I think the concept of the Anunnaki as physical giants is incorrect. I do not believe they were necessarily physical giants. They may have been giants in terms of intellect and giants in terms of a lot of their capabilities. But I'm beginning to think that that's more of a fanciful interpretation of who they were. I don't think that they were necessarily a whole lot different than us, other than the longer lifespan. And I think that their genetics, they've played with their own genetics to the point where they are indistinguishable from what we would call normal human beings. So there's a little gem for you. How's that one?
That's interesting. It's funny. You have a wonderful section in your book called The Dawn of the Secret Societies, and you brought up Sitchin. But you also brought up something that I hadn't heard of before. Maybe I had, but I hadn't really paid attention. And you direct the reader to a place called the Corridor of the Kings. And this is a timetable that the Egyptians created. It's part of a building that Seti the First built. And,
yeah, it's adjacent to the Osirian, which is a temple set up to Osiris.
And the Osirian itself is a fascinating building because it's like no other building in pre-dynastic Egypt.
Egypt, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's huge, megalithic, multi-thousand-ton stones stacked and placed in precise order. No mortar is used. Nothing is used to adhere these together, the stones together. It's just an immense structure. And next to it is this Corridor of the Kings. And talk a little bit about that, because it not only describes the kings that we know about, it goes back tens of thousands of years to chronicle the gods, which in mythology were actually human beings. But talk a little bit about that, because that's a fascinating piece of ancient history that a lot of people don't talk about.
Yeah, the Corridor of the Kings is actually, like I said, in the temple that Seti the First built adjacent to the Osirian. And in it, you see a depiction of Seti the First, and I think his son as well. And then you see a series of hieroglyphs which name all of the predecessors of Seti I. All the pharaohs that go all the way back, and it goes back, many, 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 many generations. And then it continues to go back even further generations all the way back to at least 10,000 BC. If you add up a typical common lifespan of a human being, it just goes on and on and on and on. And these names are not familiar to other scholars. They're not well known. They're only in this one location. And, you know, you basically have to put blinders on and pretend that they weren't just really naming real people, that they made all this history up of the gods, and it just doesn't make any sense. The logical conclusion is that these are the names of real gods and demigods who were associated with, you know, these extraterrestrial races, and that they're actually naming on this panel. So it's an amazing piece of history. I'd love to go see it sometime, and it really does show that the reign of the pharaohs supposedly goes back far, far beyond what we consider to be the history of dynastic Egypt.
Yeah, so there's definitely a prehistory that we don't know about.
Right.
Except there is some very, very interesting engravings very close to that area, Abydos, the temple building, and that is something that has been speculated about for a long time. You describe it in depth in your book, and you try to show the great deal of attempted cover-up of these war machines, as you call them, where this one panel, and for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, in his book, there's a specific panel that shows the presence of tanks, of helicopters, of other war machines, including what looks like planes and machines that fly on the surface of the earth, that must be prehistoric, pre-diluvian in creation. And there's been a tremendous amount of fighting and inner fighting and speculation on these carvings being either symbols that are misinterpreted or the actual identifications of machines. And what can you tell us a little bit about that, Mike?
Well, yeah, in the temple at Abydos, there is an area where they're up above a column, the pillar that's holding up the part of the roof. There are a series of hieroglyphs, and in this one area very near a pillar, a large section, maybe 2-3 feet across of the hieroglyphs, the panel, had fallen down and shattered. And behind it, they found another panel, which obviously is far, far older than just the few thousand to 4,000 or 5,000 years of the plaster in front of it. It was quite obviously much, much older. It was in fantastic condition, and it showed objects that undeniably represent and appear to be identical to a tank, a helicopter, an airplane, and various other implements and devices of war. And they are absolutely modern looking in their appearance. They look like the tank looks almost exactly like an M1 tank. And the only explanation for this is that it's a palmipedus, which is an Egyptologist term or an archaeologist term for a panel or a stela that has been damaged by being, you know, plastered on top of, and then the plaster's fallen away, and it's created new, you know, hybrid hieroglyphs that didn't really exist. But the problem with that explanation is that this panel behind the original ones that there, or the later one that fell off, is pristine. It's in perfect condition. It is perfectly preserved. It is not damaged. It is not beat up. And even one of the Egyptologists says, well, you know, one of the real problems with that explanation is that the panel itself is pristine. And he uses that word. So the bottom line is that explanation holds zero water completely. It is absolutely not a palmipedus. I forget how to pronounce it, but that's not what it is. And very clearly, it does represent war machines because the other hieroglyphs around it discuss battles and wars and how the pharaoh at the moment had defeated, you know, the the nine bows of the enemy, that there were nine battles and they could think of them. And then, so you've got war machines depicted in a panel that also has hieroglyphs talking about fighting a war. And then if you connect that back with the later Sitchin translations of various stelas and cylinder seals in Sumer, where he describes in detail various battles that were fought with various weapons and war machines, both in Egypt and in Sumer, back in the pre- and post-Diluvian times, then the connection becomes even more obvious, that you're simply talking about and representing objects that were used in some of these battles. So, you know, to me, it's always been a fascinating thing. It was great to finally, like, address Abydos and address this in a book somewhere and really do it in a way that I felt thoroughly kind of debunks the myth that these are somehow some sort of accident or hybridization of different hieroglyphs. It's clearly not that at all. And,
yeah.
And it's pretty undeniable. You know, that these things
but
represent
that really,
helicopters.
Yeah, it really makes the Egyptologists uncomfortable when you identify it so cleanly, even though there really isn't any other interpretation. I just can't, I mean, as I
no,
look at
I
these
mean,
graphics, I mean, the tank looks like a tank. The helicopter
yep.
looks like a modern helicopter. And
yep. Very similar to an Apache. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean... I guess they just don't feel like they can reveal. I mean, it throws a wrench into everything they've been taught. And so from an educational
yes.
academic point of view, it just gives them tremendous pain
well,
to even look at.
Yeah, I mean, if you acknowledge that that's what they are, then you have to say, well, not only is human history completely different than the linear, you know, ascent from caveman with, you know, caveman to modern man. Not only is that not correct, but that you do introduce the very distinct possibility of some sort of ancient alien intervention, because where did these machines come from? Who built them? Who designed them? Who created them? And that opens up even more uncomfortable questions for the mainstreamers. So, yeah, it is really quite a fascinating find, and it's something that's pretty undeniable.
Yeah. Now, the book Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies continues, and we get into something that you discuss in your lectures and in your presentations, but I'd like you to talk a little bit about it to our audience, and that is the Freemasons and their influence on not only NASA, but other government agencies, and why you feel that this is a major secretive organization that has its roots in potential alien background.
Well, I don't know that the Masons are all that secretive. They're pretty much all over the place. When you look at NASA, it's pretty easy to trace their footsteps, you know, as they their fingerprints as they went through various different aspects of the agency. So what most people do not realize is that, you know, NASA was fairly well dominated and controlled by the Freemasons from really from its inception in the late 1950s. James Webb, who was John F. Kennedy's director of NASA, was a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemason. Of course, Vice President Johnson was part of the space program, was a Freemason, and many, many of the astronauts were. The guy, Kenneth Kleinconnect, who ran the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs at various levels was a Freemason. So you have these guys pretty much all over the agency. Their fingerprints, again, are all over the space agency. And then you had a number of the astronauts who were Freemasons. Most notably, I think, is the second man to walk on the moon, Buzz Aldrin. Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to set foot on the moon. And various other guys, Alan Shepard, you know, they were all Freemasons. And not only that, they all belonged to the same lodge. So when you mm-hmm. when you start to piece it all back together, you can see this clear, undeniable pattern of the Freemasons having tremendous interest in the American space program. And, you know, the reason then, or the question then becomes why? Why would you be interested in this sort of thing if you were a Freemason? And the answer is because the roots of Freemasonry do trace all the way back to ancient Egypt, which is the first of the secret mystery schools that was probably created, and it was apparently created by the Sumerian god Marduk, for whom the city of Cairo, Mars, is named, and who established his base in ancient Egypt, at least according to the Sumerian records, established his base in ancient Egypt after the atomic exchange, the nuclear war that took place between the Anunnaki after the Great Flood. So, you know, it's a history that's basically, you can trace it in one straight line from the post-flood era into the Apollo moon landings. And to me, it's absolutely fascinating to watch all these things connect.
Would you say that the, now, I think you have written in your other books that the Freemason works all its way up to the NASA administration as well as other high high rank,
Masonry's roots. They're the religious roots. Masonry's religious roots are Egyptian, and they basically honor the Egyptian gods Isis, Osiris, and Horus, and they were the mother, father, and son. The avenging sun, Horus, and they're, you know, it's all connected in the iconography of NASA and the space program and all that stuff I wrote with Richard Helgwin in Dark Mission. So, you know, there is a direct link between Freemasonry and the rites and myths of ancient Egypt. And in fact, it was an Egyptian, Dr. Farouk Elbaz, an Egyptian, quote, geologist whose father was an expert in the ancient Egyptian stellar religion, who picked all the landing sites for the Apollo missions for the most part. So, you know, I mean, it's just it's a series of strokes like that that you can see while there's just connection.
But is there a certain behavior that is noticeable that you've studied in these Freemason types? As an example, do you think Mike Malin is a Freemasoner? Because you can't get anything out of the guy.
No, you know, I don't know about Malin. I've never really asked. I guess I could find out some of the lodges around his, see if he's a member of the lodges around his area. I don't know that he is. What I do know is that he follows the precepts of Freemasonry and of NASA, which is a sort of ritualistic, it's kind of a ritualistic pattern of landing when the stars of certain key constellations are in certain positions in the sky. And he's definitely followed that. And that traces back to another part of the book I talk about, which is the Sumerian gods, the Anunnaki, used what they called tablets of destiny. And these so-called tablets of destiny were informations, they were astronomical and astrological charts, which not only predicted the future, but guided them, allowed them to travel from the Earth to Mars, from Mars back to Nibiru, in such a way that they had the best chance of making their missions be successful. And I'm not just talking about from a mechanical standpoint, I'm talking about from an almost religious or magical standpoint. In other words, the astrological aspect of it, that the stars are in an auspicious place, was part of that pattern that they used repeatedly over and over again. And, you know, I think that Malin and NASA certainly have their own versions of the tablets of destiny, and I think that they continue to operate guided by them. I mean, you know, I've always wondered, why do they do this religious thing? Why do they do this when the stars are at 19.5 degrees above the landing site, or 33 degrees that Richard and I were always talking about in Dark Mission? And finally, in researching this book, going through Sitchin, I realized, well, this is what it is. It's the same stuff, the secret, you know, charts that are being used at NASA are the same ones that the Sumerians used or the Anunnaki used.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
So anyway, you know, I mean, I really, that part of the book is to me the most revelatory. It was just like, wow, okay, so, you know, there was a big battle between Enlil and another king, or king candidate, you know, royalty, member of the royal house of the Anunnaki, and he stole the tablets of destiny, and these were like really, really important. And I'm like, well, what were these things? And then you begin to read about them and you begin to understand that it's exactly the same kind of thing that NASA would have to have if they were operating under the ritual pattern that Richard and I have always claimed that they were. So just like one thread connects to another. It's just amazing.
For those of you who are listening and don't know who we're referring to, Mike Malin runs the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and I guess he's in charge of the imaging because he was the main focus for camera. Remember?
He runs Malin Space Science Systems in San Diego, and he designed the camera for the Mars Global Surveyor, which gave us the most significant images of Mars that we've had. And I believe he's involved in the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter camera as well. And basically, mm-hmm. If you want pictures of Mars, you have to go through Mike Malin. And he's been less than forthcoming with the information over the years. So, little by little, bit by bit, he's let things out. But he's pretty much NASA's main guy when it comes to, images of Mars. And he's been involved in several skullduggerous attempts to debunk.
Right. Now, we heard from John Brandenburg last week, Dr. Brandenburg, that he believes that the government is open and that there's tons of photographs out there that are easily accessible. But I didn't say anything about that because to my mind, it seems like Malin the technology is such that he can probably see the pinhead on the surface of Mars with the equipment, and we haven't seen anything close to that. We've seen his famous cat box, the face on Mars at an angle where it's such the face has been kicked around, but Malin, in my mind, has probably some amazing photographs that he's not revealing.
I'd love to go down there and, sort through the real pictures sometime. Because the thing is that you have the cat box incident, the very famous cat box incident, which I talk about in Ancient Aliens on Mars. And, that was Len Fleming, the contractor for NASA, essentially proved that was a deliberate scientific fraud. It was deliberately, not only did they take the picture at the worst possible angle, but they messed with it, in ways that were designed to make it look as rock-like as possible and as little like a face as possible. And that came from JPL. It may not have come from, it may not have been Malin himself, but it certainly came from his controllers, his masters at JPL. It was intended to be that way. And, also as we've gotten more and more close-up images of the face, there are discrepancies between the European data and the NASA data, the Malin control data. And there are areas on the face on Mars where the Malin's images are absolutely blank, but there's this weird sort of mesh pattern almost in the background. Now, that mesh pattern is one of two things. Either it's an artificial crisscrossing pattern on the face on Mars, which is some sort of underlying mesh that was used to build it, or it is evidence of image tampering, because they clearly do not appear in the European data, and the European data also seems to show what looked like spars and rebar and things like that you would expect if the face was a constructed artifact. So we've got a lot of issues like that have come up over the years.
I, for one, am very happy that the European Space Agency has re-imaged Mars. Do you think that they are forthcoming with their imagery? Do you think it's all up and up, or do you think they're being editing some of the stuff we're seeing?
Well, they're more forthcoming than NASA. Let's put it that way. One of the things that happened when the Mars Express took the first pictures of the face on Mars back in 2006 was that the color images of the face on Mars was that they were directly overhead, which has not been done by Malin. And there was also color images were used. European Space Agency data was used, and it was put together with data from Malin and JPL and supposedly to create a 3D representation of the face on Mars. Well, when they got done with the 3D representation, the face on Mars suddenly grew a gigantic lump in the middle of the forehead, which I call that the elephant man version of the face on Mars. And again, it was a complete fabrication. It was a complete fabrication designed to make people think that this was a natural hill. And The European Space Agency version had none of that information in it. The lump never existed. So, again, this is the kind of stuff we've had to put up with over the years from NASA and JPL.
It's a challenge. We have a little bit of time left, a few minutes. I want to go back a little bit to the early space program post World War II, and I want you to talk just a little bit about Warren von Braun and the other Nazi scientists that the Americans basically brought to the U.S. to kickstart their rocket program. Was there more to it than just being rocket scientists? Was there something more that the secret society, the secret groups were trying to capture when they brought them over? Or was it just for science?
Cool. Well, one of my favorite pictures of Dr. von Braun is one that was taken in, I believe, Fort Bliss, Texas, when he and some of his Nazi buddies were staying there as guests of the U.S. government and being debriefed about the V-2 rocket and so forth. And so a picture of von Braun and a few of his friends standing in front of a saloon. And on the signpost above them is a flying saucer, a disc-shaped object, and a swastika. So you tell me if there was anything more to von Braun and his Nazi scientist friends. So the truth is that NASA was controlled from the early on by the Freemasons, by the what I call the Nazi faction, which was von Braun and his German rocket scientists. And then out in JPL, you had what we call, what Richard and I dubbed the magicians, which is sort of followers of L. Ron Hubbard and Aleister Crowley, who were involved in a whole lot of really weird stuff out here in Pasadena. So there's no question that there was a lot more going on, including perhaps studies of advanced propulsion systems, because around White Sands, New Mexico, where they were doing the V-2 test, there were also some strange disc-shaped objects seen over the years. So I think, you know, without a doubt, there was something more going on there. But at this point, we're not really sure what.
Okay. And then I want to ask you what you feel is, and you briefly told us a little bit earlier in the program that you believe that the Anunnaki or there's some Nephilim influence. Do you think that there is off-world influence in our space program?
The question is, in what sense? Do we have technology from off-world? I don't know. We seem to be operating at a very lowest common denominator kind of level, so I really couldn't tell you. I do think that the purpose of the Apollo program was to return to the moon, retrieve Anunnaki technology, and also to acknowledge to them, show them in some big way that we had, you know, reached out back to where we came from, which was beyond the Earth. And I think that was the purpose of the Apollo program. It was both symbolic and mechanical, in the sense that we were trying to obtain Anunnaki technology to hopefully exploit here on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you make a lot of cases for that in Dark Mission, your book with Richard Hoagland, of ruins, crystal or glass ruins, and technology being left on the moon. Is there a new information that has come forth, or is it always going to be secretive just because it's of such a nature that only a select few of individuals would have access to that knowledge?
Well, I mean, in terms of the crystal structures on the moon, I mean, you know, at my presentation this last week in San Francisco, one of the things I did is when NASA puts something out, I like to flip it upside down and see what it looks like when you flip it upside down. And in this particular case, they claim that there was a landslide down the side of a crater that they had photographed with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and it looked like a bunch of very bright material running down the side of this crater. But when you flip it upside down, you suddenly realize it's this very highly reflective, very jagged, broken glass towering structures that are hundreds of meters tall sticking up out of the ground. It's exactly the opposite of what NASA says it is. And again, you can just do this just by flipping their images upside down. So I would encourage everybody, if you're looking at NASA images, look at them the way they present them, and then flip them upside down and see what they look like that way, too, because a lot of times they take on a completely different character when you actually observe them in the way that you would really see them if you were actually flying over the surface of the moon. So, you know, is there new information? There's constantly new information coming out. The question is, you know, does any one person have enough time to look at all of it, analyze it, and get it out there? And the answer is no, but, you know, I'm trying, other people are trying, and other people are succeeding, too. I actually met a guy this weekend who's got telescopic images of the lunar surface that are quite extraordinary, showing really, really amazing stuff. So, you know.
Interesting.
I told him to publish it, and, you know, when it gets published, we'll definitely put it out to people and get them to try to look at it too.
Interesting. Okay, so the last question, I'm going to ask you the question that was asked of you this weekend at the George Norrie's panel, and that is, what do you, Mike Barra, best-selling author, visionary, think the future of technology, and what's the future of our interaction with off-world beings? Or is there going to be exposure? Is there going to be revelation? Is there going to be kind of a coming out party? What's going to happen? What's your prediction?
No, I honestly don't think so, because I think that politically, you know, the so-called disclosure concept of a government announcement is politically destabilizing. And anybody who's at the top of the political food chain is not going to want to introduce a politically destabilizing issue into the body politic, because they don't have, unless they have to. And if they don't have to, they just wouldn't do it, because the only place they can go if they're at the top is down. The only thing that can happen to them is that they can fall from their exalted position. So I just honestly don't think it's going to happen. And if it does happen, quite frankly, I'm going to head for the hills, because that means, you know, the end is nigh. That means that they're trying to clear all the books off and shred all the documents before the fan. So, you know, I'm not a big believer in the disclosure concept. I don't really think it's going to go anywhere. And quite frankly, Cliff, you know, all of us listening to this show and that are interested in this subject, we know what the truth is, and we don't need a government, especially this particular very corrupt and dishonest government, to confirm anything for us. At least I don't. I know what the truth is, and I don't need them to confirm it one way or the other. I really don't. I really don't care what Barack Obama and John Boehner think about this issue, because they're not important. There's other things that are important, and what matters is what we think, not what they think, and what we know, not what they know.
For two decades, I have been wondering and wanting to see, I'm really tired and frustrated of seeing blurry pictures of UFOs, have seen pictures of so-called aliens, of hearing the channel information from whoever about, you know, they're channeling some alien brothers or sisters. I mean, it's to me, it's like, it's time that we have some visitations that are solid, that it's like, okay, if you're out there, come on down. Come on down. Let's open the craft and come out and talk to us or communicate. So when I hear you say you don't see it happening, it's kind of sad, because if there is a sophisticated alien presence and they're afraid to communicate with us because they're afraid of getting their head shot off or starting a war, I think that's pretty sad. But you could be right. We could be in an evolutionary stage that doesn't allow us to have a meeting.
Well, I wouldn't count on it, Cliff, except at a very personal level. I understand that can generally be arranged. If you really want to have contact, I'm sure somebody can drop by and visit you. But, you know, sometimes that involves probing certain delicate areas of the body that you don't necessarily want probed.
So oh, my God. Okay.
I wouldn't recommend that.
Well, haven't you heard about Stephen Greer's program where he actually works with certain light signals and they go out to the desert? And wait a minute, you're going to be going out to the desert pretty soon, aren't you? Aren't you guys going to be looking for UFOs when you go out to do the desert program?
I will be going to contact in the desert, absolutely, and it will be
okay.
It will be another tremendous experience, I'm sure, and you know, hopefully it won't get too personal. Let's put it that way.
Okay, my guest has been Mike Barra. The book is Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. It's a great book. I just had a chance to work through it. It's a very, very detailed, well-written book. And for those of you who have a lot of questions about pre-Diluvian society, pre-Diluvian Earth, pre-dynastic Egypt, it's a great primer for that. Mike ties a lot of things together. And I just checked. The book is on Amazon. It's in digital form as well as a paperback, so definitely take a look at it. Mike, before I let you go, why don't you tell us about where you're going to be in the next week or two or in a month? I know you just mentioned out in the California desert, but are you going to be anywhere else? You want to let our audience know?
Well, I'm going to be at the opening on a couple nights of the U2 tour in Vancouver, BC, but that doesn't, I'm not going to be talking there. but no, that's it. I'm going to be going to contact in the desert at the end of May and then first weekend of May, June. That's the next big appearance. And then after that, I'll be doing MUFON in Philly, and that will be in August. And we're trying to hook up a couple of other gigs in between. But now, right now, the best way to look for things is to connect with me on my blog. It's mikebarra.blogspot.com. It's B-A-R-A, just one R. And, you know, I've got, again, appearances scheduled there. And of course, there's always Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. So by all means, look for me on those sites, too.
Okay, Mike, thanks for joining us. We will definitely check back to you again. So thank you much.
Okay. It's my pleasure, Cliff. Thanks.
So that was Mike Barra talking about his new book, Ancient Aliens and Secret Societies. It's brand new. Just came out a few weeks ago. And it is it's a good book. I really liked it. And as I mentioned in that interview, Mike ties up a lot of loose ends regarding secret societies, and his biggest focus and his most of his research has had to do with American space program, primarily NASA, but he also gets in the JPL. So that's today's program. Remember, if you're in Northern California next Friday, come on by Art as a Spiritual Journey. I'll be at the Redux Studio, 2350 Lincoln Avenue. I'll post a few photographs and come in and say hi. Happy to meet with you. We can talk about anything you want to talk about, and we can enjoy some fantastic art and a glass of the bubbly if you're so inclined. Have a great day, and I look forward to chatting. Next week our guest is Paul Badrul, who wrote an amazing book called Awaken Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer. And in the book, he shows that mythology isn't actually mythology in many ways. It's part of our present day consciousness and has influenced us in ways that we don't really realize. So that's next Saturday on our program. Stay tuned, and I hope you'll join us. Thank you.